You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight we consider what was it like to actually collaborate with, to publish, to know that most unconventional writer, Samuel Beckett. And tonight two very special guests, Jeanette Seaver and Alan Mandel, will offer their unique perspectives on Beckett, that Irish-born Nobel Prize-winning author who was James Joyce's amanuensis, a fighter with the French Resistance, and one of the greatest writers of all time. I think so. Jeanette Seaver, who with her husband Richard discovered and published Beckett's early work, will read from the Seaver's memoir about the golden age of publishing, and Alan Mandel will read Stirring Still, which, as Alan says, arguably is Beckett's last major prose piece. And after their individual presentations, they'll be joined by moderator Howard Rodman, screenwriter and professor of screenwriting at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. And then we will open to you for questions. So wait till the microphone comes to you. Please try and make your question a question, which would be great. And afterwards, Jeanette will be signing her memoir in the lobby. Jeanette Seaver, who is going to be up first tonight, was born in Paris and began her career as a concert violinist. She met her future husband, Richard Seaver, one of literature's most daring editors, in Paris when he was running the influential literary magazine Merlin. Together, they formed Seaver Books at Viking Press and later Arcade Publishing, where for over 20 years, they discovered and published new literary voices from other cultures, including two Nobel laureates, Octavio Paz and Mo Yan. Arcade Publishing closed following Richard Seaver's unexpected death in 2009, and currently Jeanette serves as editor of Arcade Publishing at Skyhorse, which acquired the Arcade backlist. Jeanette edited Richard Seaver's marvelous memoir titled The Tender Hour of Twilight, Paris in the 50s, New York in the 50s, a memoir of publishing's golden age. And it's been hailed as a priceless eyewitness account of the making of a literary generation between Paris and New York. It's a fabulous read. And if you're considering how to be an avant-garde literary editor or an avant-garde writer or want to know about the great history of publishing in this country and in France, make this memoir your Bible. And Jeanette will be signing it, as I said, in the lobby after the program. We're delighted she could be here tonight from New York and Paris. Alan Mandel, a Beckett scholar, has had a distinguished 75-year acting career. He's a founding member of the famed San Francisco Actors Workshop and co-founder of the San Quentin Drama Workshop, which started in 1957 with a performance of Waiting for Godot inside the prison. Mandel toured Europe with original productions of Godot and Endgame directed by Beckett and has appeared on Broadway. And some of you here might have been lucky enough to see Alan when he appeared in Godot at the Mark Taper Forum in 2012. Great production. So we will begin tonight with Jeanette Seaver at the podium, but first, please give all three of our guests a warm welcome to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Well, I'm very honored to be here, and I thank you, Louise, for inviting me to speak about my husband's memoir, The Tender Hour of Twilight. And I thank Howard, where is Howard? Somewhere. Rodman, really a man of letters, extraordinaire, for spearheading this evening. And then I'm delighted you are our moderator. I also want to thank my daughter, Natalie Seaver, who put on her former producer hat and suggested focusing on the Beckett chapters of the memoir and came up with the concept of the magical partnership. Last but not least, the formidable, brilliant actor, Monsieur Mandel, here with us, who will share his insights on his magical partnership with Samuel Beckett. Thank you, everybody. Now, the memoir is about a young man, an intellectual in Paris, who is deeply involved in James Joyce at the Sorbonne and an editor in a literary magazine called Merlin. He walks down the streets and sees in a little house that turns out to be the French publishing house, Les Éditions Minuit, two books in the window with Irish names, and he leans over thinking it's a translation by an unknown Irish writer, Samuel Beckett. He buys the books, and they are written in French indeed, and he is knocked out. He's at the same time starting to be with the Merlin group, who have asked Dick to bring French authors to the magazine. So I will read a very short or two paragraphs of that moment where Alex Trocchi, who runs the magazine, is questioning Dick about the French writers. "You mentioned," Alex speaking, "you know some French writers we might want to publish," Alex said, turning to me. "One in particular," I said, fixing Trocchi's gaze. "Extraordinary, like nothing I've ever read. He's Irish." "He's Irish? I asked you for a French writer." "Well, his name is Samuel Beckett. I came upon him several months ago, and I've read everything he's written, or at least everything available. Some of his early works are out of print. He lives in Paris and he writes in French, so you could consider him a French writer." "So, how did you come upon him? And what has he written?" Trocchi wanted to know. "Three novels," I said. "At least one play." This is in 1952, so at least one play. "And a couple of short stories, all in French. There's also apparently a slim volume of poems, an earlier volume of stories called More Pricks Than Kicks. Those are written in English. So how did you come upon this Irish unknown writer who writes in French?" "Chance," I said, "chance and geography. I live on the Rue du Sabot, the little street on the left bank, and to get to Saint-Germain, I usually go by the Rue Bernard Palissy, where there is a young French publishing house, Les Éditions de Minuit." Do you hear me, by the way? I wasn't sure. Okay. "Last year, in the window of Minuit, I saw two books displayed, Molloy and Malone, by one Samuel Beckett. The name rang a Joycean bell, but for the life of me, I couldn't figure what an Irishman was doing chez Minuit. I assumed they were translations, so I asked the lady who runs the English bookstore, and George Whitman, who now has just passed away, who was the head of Shakespeare and Company, if they'd heard, or were they carrying the books, and they said, "We've never heard of the writer. Don't know who you're talking about." So this is now going to page 201. Sorry. I just wanted to say, subsequently, Dick got to know Monsieur Beckett, and Beckett asked him to translate some of his shorter writings, the short stories, Le Calmant, I mean, it's called the Calmative, The End, and they were published in Merlin. And Beckett was very pleased, extremely pleased with Dick's translation. And actually subsequently asked Dick if he would kindly translate Molloy as well as Godot, could you imagine? And Dick, at the time, was finishing his 350-page thesis on Joyce and had a deadline and declined. So, I later on read a little passage. The Trokey, Alex Trokey, was so impressed by the presentation of this unknown writer that he asked Dick if he would write an essay for the magazine. And Dick felt it was a tall order, but he would certainly try. And indeed, you know, he wrote this very first time ever essay on Beckett, which was published, and the magazine found its way to America and came into the hands of then a new American publisher who had just bought a young publishing house called Grove Press. When Barney Rossett, the publisher of Grove Press, read Dick's piece, he flew to Paris and asked for a meeting, and this is the other, and asked if Dick would perhaps introduce him to this Mr. Beckett. So later on in the book, there's a little passage that relates to that. I paid some attention to a letter I received one day from a gentleman who said he was a New York publisher. His name was Barney Rossett, and he had recently bought a publishing house called Grove Press. He had read and liked my piece on Beckett and the extract of What in the following issue. And both the extract and what I said about the Irishman intrigued him greatly. He would be coming to Paris in late summer or early fall and wondered if we could meet, perhaps have lunch. Could I possibly arrange a meeting with Mr. Beckett, please? And I found just recently some notes looking through Dick's things on What, and I will just share one or two lines. Having recently reread What, probably for the fifth or sixth time since that all-night reading on the Rue du Sabot, it strikes me still as one of the funniest of all Beckett's works and one of the most successful. As in all of Beckett's, the construction of What is as meticulous as its language. What happened was, I have to read you the other. Here we go. Dick had expressed an interest with a French publisher to meet Mr. Beckett. It didn't really happen for a long time, but he found his address, and he took his bicycle across Paris and dropped a letter to Mr. Beckett, where he's asking kindly to see the manuscript of What. Would he be interested? They would love to see it and publish it. They didn't hear from Beckett for the longest time. Beckett was traveling, actually. So this is the place, the moment. We had all but given up hope of ever hearing from Beckett when one dark and stormy early evening in late November, as we were preparing a spaghetti dinner at the Rue du Sabot, this is where Dick lived, a knock came on the door, at the door. The noise of the rain on the glass roof above was so deafening, we barely heard the knock. When finally I answered, there, outlined in the light, was a tall, gaunt figure in a raincoat, water streaming down from the brim of the nondescript hat jammed on top of his head. From inside the folds of his raincoat, he fished out a package, not even wrapped against the downpour, a manuscript bound in a black imitation leather binder. You asked me for this, he said, thrusting the package into my hand. Here it is. At which point I realized this was What? And the rain-soaked silhouette, Mr. Beckett himself. Thank you, I managed. You must be drenched. Won't you come in? Can't, he said. I must be off. Let me know what you think. And he pronounced the last word as though it had no H. Tink. With which he turned and strode off into the night. I turned back to the others who had paid scant attention to the business at the door and held my trophy aloft. What? I declared. The long lost what? What? Said Patrick. I said, what? We know what you said, Troki mimicked. We just don't know what you mean. Sounds like who's on first, said somebody. So that's a very sweet. And that's how what came into Dick's hands and how it was published in Maryland. And all of the editors that night with the spaghetti dinner cooking didn't eat spaghetti, but read what, each one a chapter or a few pages throughout the night. And by morning, they all said, yes, we are publishing, not only in the magazine, but we will become now book publishers. And they found some money, and indeed, they published the first edition, the first book of what. And I remember they either ran out of money or something happened at the printer. The cover appeared magenta, and they were horrified, and so was Beckett. He kept calling the juvenile, the Merlin juvenile, and their magenta cover, but he was very happy. This was really a very... You have to realize that since Murphy, which had been Beckett's first novel, which had been published before Second World War, there had been no publication in English of any of Beckett's work. In fact, everything he had written, he had sent to all the various British publishers who systematically rejected Beckett's work. So this was a hiatus of almost 15 years. For him, it was a resurrection. It was extraordinary to have his book published in English, which was subsequently, of course, when Grove Press acquired all of Beckett's work and became the American publisher of Beckett, and Dick became the editorial director of Grove. Dick became again his his editor on the other side of the Atlantic, and the two, Dick and Beckett, had an extremely close relationship. And it started when Dick translated Beckett's work. They worked together for weeks, every day at 4 o'clock at the Dome Cafe. And they really, a huge bond was formed, and it became a lifelong friendship. And when I entered shortly thereafter in Dick's life, I joined this partnership again for the rest of the Sam's life. We had many, many walks, many dinners, many wonderful close, you know, everybody said he's so somber, he's so dark. Not at all. Once you passed a certain threshold, he was your friend, and he was very funny. He was very funny, and he liked to laugh, and Dick made him laugh a great deal. He also enjoyed a glass of Irish whiskey now and then, and everything was fine. Even at the last months of his life, we went to see him in his, what was it called, rest place? I hate retire, thank you. We brought him, you know, the Irish whiskey, and he was very happy, opened it, and we all had a drink. am I missing something here? There were many, many things. We were discussing with Alan Mandel backstage, the same kind of experience happened to both of us. You know, Sam would come to dinner at my home in Paris, and after one of the Sunday dinners, he and my then 11-year-old son repaired to the balcony and played chess. Now, I didn't know at the time that Sam was a champion chess player, and of course he wiped out poor little Alex, who very politely said, thank you, Mr. Baker, thank you, and that was that. 2 years later, back in New York in Trinity School, they were studying Samuel Beckett. And Alex realized that the guy who'd wiped him out was Mr. Beckett. I think something quite similar happened to your son, too, as I understand. I have so many notes, I don't want to overstay my welcome. Funny little other thing, you know, Beckett was an immensely private man, and you never saw Beckett at any cocktail party. He hated cocktail party. He hated crowds. For those who were close to him, you had two or three spots in Paris where he chose to have dinner or lunch and so forth. When you were to meet Sam, first of all, he had a telephone, but he never answered the phone. That just was out of... So you had to send him a note. And in those days, you have to remember, it was before internet, before fax. There was something wonderful in Paris that had existed for almost 100 years, the pneumatique, which is you went to the post office, and you wrote your note, they rolled it up like a cigar, and there was a whole network of tubes underneath Paris, and they would shoot it, literally, and it would arrive within a half an hour. You paid quite a lot of money for it, but it was the only means of reaching someone. So we would send a pneumatique to Sam and say, meet you at 8 o'clock at the Closerie de Lila. Please call us to confirm. Then he would call. He would make the call, but he would not pick up the phone if it rang. So those were the little things. As I said, I'm not here as a Beckett scholar tonight. I'm here as a very close friend of Beckett. Do I need to do more reading? Have I gone over my time, Louise?
I think it's perfect,
Jeanette. Is it perfect? Perfect meaning enough. Thank you.
One night, as he sat at his table, head on hands, he saw himself rise and go. One night or day. For when his own light went out, he was not left in the dark. Light of a kind came then from the one high window. Under it, still. The stool on which, till he... Under it still, the stool on which till he could or would no more, he used to mount to see the sky. Why he did not crane out to see what lay beneath was perhaps because the window was not made to open, or perhaps because he could or would not open it. Perhaps he knew only too well what lay beneath and did not wish to see it again. So he would simply stand there, high above the earth, and see through the clouded pane the cloudless sky, its faint, unchanging light, unlike any light he could remember from the days and nights when day followed hard on night and night on day. This outer light, then, when his own went out, became his only light, till it in its turn went out and left him in the dark, till it, in its turn, went out. One night, or day then, as he sat at his table, head on hands, he saw himself rise and go. First rise and stand clinging to the table, then sit again. Then rise again and stand clinging to the table again. Then go, start to go. On unseen feet, start to go, so slow that only change of place to show he went. As when he disappeared only to reappear later at another place. Then disappeared again only to reappear again later at another place again. And so again and again disappeared again. only to reappear again later at another place again. Another place in the place where he sat at his table, head on hands. The same place and table as when Darley, for example, died and left him, as when others too in their turn, before and since, as when others would too in their turn and leave him, till he too, in his turn, head on hands, half hoping when he disappeared again that he would not reappear again, and half fearing that he would not, or merely wondering, or merely waiting, waiting to see if he would or would not leave him or not, alone again, waiting for nothing again. Seen always from behind, whithersoever he went, same hat and coat as of old when he walked the roads, the back roads. Now, as one in a strange place seeking the way out, in the dark, in a strange place, blindly in the dark of night or day, seeking the way out, a way out to the roads, the back roads. A clock afar struck the hours and half hours, the same as when, among others, Darley once died and left him. Strokes now clear, as if carried by a wind, now faint on the still air. Cries afar, now faint, now clear. Head on hands, half hoping when the hour struck that the half hour would not, and half fearing that it would not. Similarly, when the half hour struck, similarly, when the cries a moment ceased, or merely wondering, or merely waiting, waiting to hear. There had been a time he would sometimes lift his head enough to see his hands, what of them was to be seen, one laid on the table and the other on the one, at rest after all they did. Lift his past head a moment to see his past hands, then lay it back on them to rest it too, after all it did. The same place as when left day after day for the roads, the back roads. Returned to night after night, paced from wall to wall in the dark, the then fleeting dark of night. Now, as if strange to him, seen to rise and go, disappear and reappear at another place, disappear again and reappear again at another place again, or at the same, nothing to show, not the same. No wall toward which or from, no table back toward which or further from, in the same place as when paced from wall to wall, all places as the same, or in another, nothing to show, not another, where never, rise and go in the same place as ever, disappear and reappear in another, where never, nothing to show, not another, where never, nothing but the strokes, the cries, the same as ever, till so many strokes and cries since he was last seen, that perhaps he would not be seen again, then so many cries since the strokes were last heard, that perhaps they would not be heard again, then such silence since the cries were last heard, that perhaps even they would not be heard again. Perhaps thus the end, unless no more than a mere lull. Then all is before, the strokes and cries as before, and he as before, now there, now gone, now there again, now gone again. Then the lull again. Then all is before again, so again and again, and patience till the one true end to time and grief and self and second self, his own. As one in his right mind, when at last out again, he knew not how, he was not long out again, when he began to wonder if he was in his right mind. For could one not in his right mind be reasonably said to wonder if he was in his right mind, and bring what is more his remains of reason to bear on this perplexity in the way he must be said to do if he is to be said at all? It was therefore in the guise of a more or less reasonable being that he emerged at last, he knew not how, into the outer world, and had not been there for more than 6 or 7 hours by the clock, when he could not but begin to wonder if he was in his right mind. By the same clock, whose strokes were those heard times without number in his confinement, as it struck the hours and half hours, and so, in a sense, at first a source of reassurance, till finally one of alarm, as being no clearer now than when in principle muffled by his four walls. Then he sought help in the thought of one hastening westward at sundown to obtain a better view of Venus, and found it of none. Of the sole other sound, that of cries, enlivener of his solitude, as, lost to suffering, he sat at his table head on hands, the same was true. Of their whenceabouts, that is, of clock and cries, the same was true, that is, no more to be determined now than as was only natural then. Bringing to bear on all this his remains of reason, he sought help in the thought that his memory of indoors was perhaps at fault, and found it of none. Further to his disarray, his soundless tread, as when barefoot he trod his floor. So all ears from bad to worse, till in the end he ceased, if not to hear, to listen, and set out to look about him. Result, finally, he was in a field of grass, which went some way, if nothing else, to explain his tread, and then a little later, as if to make up for this, some way to increase his trouble, for he could recall no field of grass, from even the very heart of which no limit of any kind was to be discovered, but always, in some quarter or another, some end in sight, such as a offense, or other manner of bourne from which to return. Nor, on his looking more closely to make matters worse, was this the short green grass he seemed to remember, eaten down by flocks and herds, but long and light gray in color, verging here and there on white. Then he sought help in the thought that his memory of outdoors was perhaps at fault, and found it of none. So all eyes, from bad to worse, till in the end he ceased, if not to see, to look about him or more closely, and set out to take thought. To this end, for want of a stone on which to sit like Voltaire and cross his legs, the best he could do was stop dead and stand stock still, which after a moment of hesitation he did, and, of course, sink his head as one deep in meditation, which, after another moment of hesitation, he did also. But soon, weary of vainly delving in these remains, he moved on through the long hoar grass, resigned to not knowing where he was, or how he got there, or where he was going, or how to get back to whence he knew not how he came. So, on, unknowing, and no end in sight, unknowing, and what is more, no wish to know, nor indeed any wish of any kind, nor therefore any sorrow, save that he would have wished the strokes to cease and the cries for good, and was sorry that they did not. The strokes, now faint, now clear, as if carried by the wind, but not a breath, and the cries, now faint, now clear, So on till stayed, when to his ears from deep within, oh, how, and here a word he could not catch it were, to end where never till then. Rest then before again from not long to so long that perhaps never again, and then again faint from deep within. Oh, how? And hear that missing word again, it were to end where never till then. In any case, whatever it might be, to end and so on, was he not already, as he stood there, all bowed down and to his ears, faint from deep within, again and again, oh, how, something, and so on? Was he not, so far as he could see, already there, where never till then? For how could even such a one as he, having once found himself in such a place, not shudder to find himself in it again, which he had not done, nor having shuddered, seek help in vain in the thought, so-called, that having somehow got out of it then, he could somehow get out of it again, which he had not done either? There, then, all this time, where never till then, and so far as he could see, in every direction, when he raised his head and opened his eyes, no danger or hope, as the case might be, of his ever getting out of it. Was he then now to press on regardless, now in one direction, now in another, or, on the other hand, stir no more, as the case might be, that is, as that missing word might be, which, if to warn such a sad or bad, for example, then, of course, in spite of all, the one, and if the reverse, then, of course, the other, that is, stir no more. Such and much more, such the hubbub in his mind, so-called, till nothing left from deep within, but only ever fainter, oh, to end, no matter how, no matter where, time and grief and self, so-called, oh, all to end. Thank you.
I'm really only good for two things, thank yous and apologies, but let's start with the thanks. Thank you to Louise and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles for putting together this evening and evenings like it. I don't think there's really anything like it in Los Angeles. There may not be anything like it anywhere. I'd like to very much say how delighted I am and honored I am to be sharing this table with two such extraordinary people. Alan and Jeanette, thank you so much for giving of your time for being here. And I'd like to very much thank all of you for coming, because a panel discussion without an audience is dismal. Unlike Jeanette and Alan, who had the honor and pleasure of knowing Mr. Beckett, I first heard about him at the age of 17 by anecdote. Somebody told me the following story, that it was the first good day of spring in London. The sky was blue. People were walking around without top coats for the first time in months. Beckett was walking with a friend in St. James Park, and the friend said, "A day like this just makes you feel glad to be alive." And Beckett said, I wouldn't go that far. Yeah. So immediately I liked this guy because, you know, he had one of the qualities that I require in my saints, which was a sense of the dismal. And the next thing I really found out about Beckett was 2 years later when I enrolled in a class taught by Frank McConnell called Irish Literature, which we referred to as Read Joyce and Sing. And that's where the apology comes in. Anyway, the first thing we read was Murphy, and it has, I think, the best first six words of any novel I've ever read. The sun shone, having no alternative.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And then I read what? Oh, my. As Jeanette told you, it's a very, very funny novel. I mean, at first, reading it in 1969, I was taken with the fact that in it was a Mr. Nixon and a Mr. Spiro. I mean, what is that about? But then I just started reading, and it was laugh-out-loud funny, rolling around funny. It was like S.J. Perlman funny or Flann O'Brien funny.
Yes. Mm.
I mean, it was a real riot. And so here was somebody who was capable of grand precision of language, a sense of the doom struck, and could make you laugh. So I had found a saint to follow. And I feel very fortunate in the rest of my life as a reader and as a theater goer. I've gotten to experience that extraordinary voice. I want to start, Jeanette, by asking you about something. In reading your husband's miraculous memoir, there's a kind of journey that he took, which Beckett was the catalyst for. Starting out as a reader, you know, the kind of reading that we all hope readers will be, you know, which is to say deeply engaged and capable of having your life transformed by what you're reading. And going from there to being a writer, the essay that he wrote for the second edition of Merlin, which was, I think, the first real appreciation of Beckett in English.
It was.
To being a translator with, there's a lovely description in the book of him working with Beckett to translate the short story Le Fin, and later the editor of, one of the friends of Merlin, later an editor of Paris Review, referred to Richard Siever's work with Beckett on that translation as, you really lit a rocket in his arse. And then, so from reader to writer to translator, then to editor and publisher. And I think none of these things might have occurred had not Beckett been there to cause those transformations. And I guess the question I want to ask is a really unfair one. Looking back on it, as we do when we read the memoir, The Tender Hour of Twilight, all of this kind of makes sense. But, you know, everything makes sense when you look back on it. At the moment, were you or he aware at just how extraordinary the work of Beckett was and just how extraordinary a set of transformations he was causing in your lives?
We were aware how extraordinary his writing was, absolutely, at the time. My husband even more so than I was. I was just learning Beckett. He'd already been immersed in Beckett. I think it changed my husband's life completely. In a funny, in a sad way, he was a young writer and he stopped writing because he felt nobody should write after reading Molloy. And it's too bad because he himself is a good writer. But it did, it was an interesting, you're right, because of Beckett, he became the editor-in-chief of Grove, and the rest of our life was around Beckett. No, we had no idea that this would be the case at the time, other than discovering it genius. I mean, Dick kept saying it's the Shakespeare of our time. And he and Beckett had a great intellectual affinity and a drôlerie. They loved, they shared the ridiculous, the absurd. And that is all I can think of at this moment. But we both had a sense of being with a person larger than life when we were with him at the time, even knowing nothing more that we didn't had no idea that he'd get the Nobel. I do remember going to the Théâtre Babylon to see Godot. Sorry, we say Godot in French.
You say Godot, I say Godot.
Well, that's what he said.
Yeah, sure.
And that's what she said.
Yeah. There were 12 people in the theater. And it got mixed reviews. And then 10 years later, maybe a little more than 10 years, after he'd already had the Nobel, the Godot production was put at the National Theater, L'Odéon. And Sam was extremely preoccupied and anguished at the idea that Godot would be performed in a large theater, whereas he had written it for such a small, as you know. He was concerned, anguished, and refused to go to the opening night. Typical. And we were supposed to have dinner together, and he said, I'm not going. Meet me at the Dome after dinner, after the theater, sorry. We walked over, and it had been, of course, this standing ovation. It was the same cast that had originally performed, Roger Blin,
oh, yes.
Jean Martin, the wonderful, yes. great actors. And but the one difference is Giacometti had created the famous one tree, remember that? And so Giacometti was there, and Sam was there, and I approached Sam and said, Sam, it was a triumph. You should be so pleased. Head in hands.
Yeah.
He was like that, and he said, Jeanette, you don't know what you're talking about. It's a terrible play. It's rubbish. I don't want to hear about it. Well, we gave him a glass of whiskey, and things got okay. But the thing with Sam is the loyalty. He had a sense of friendship extraordinary. Generosity and depth. We really felt part of him when we were with him.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're honoring him tonight with words, or as he would say, disimproving the silence. At the time that Richard came to Paris, and I think a lot of, or if not a lot of, you know, a good chunk of Americans came in search of good bread and existentialism and the one-minute light switch, which was guaranteed to plunge you into darkness before you reach your fifth-floor apartment, sans ascenseur.
Oh, la, la.
But I get a sense from reading the book that with all of, you know, the apartments were tiny, the toilet was down the hall and consisted of a set of footprints, life was not necessarily full of bounty, but to make up for it, there was this wild ferment of the mind.
Oh, very
the
much
sense
so.
That sort of, you know, life was a book with uncut pages that you
yes.
had to read.
Yes, indeed.
And in reading, when he first came to Alexander Trocki at Merlin, Alexander Trocki published this wonderful avant-garde literary magazine. It is also, in my opinion, one of the great pornographers. He supported himself for many years writing Olympia Press Traveler's Companion books.
May I interrupt?
Please. Save me
there
here.
Not at all. There was a group of writers who could not earn a living as American or English-speaking writers in France. And the only way they could pay their rent was meeting the infamous Monsieur Gérodias, who was the head of Olympia Press, who gave them all a chance to write pornography. That's what he was about. Mm. And so they did. They forced themselves and they wrote these.
As long as they were doing it, you know, to support their art.
No comment.
Yeah. But if you ever are in that kind of bookstore and come across Alexander Trocki's Helen and Desire, or Thongs. Well, anyway. But at the time, you know, he came to Trocki saying, hey, there's this guy named Beckett, who I've read. And at the time, I mean, Murphy had sold 95 copies
know,
at that point.
I know,
and also a Romanian writer who, you know, named Ionesco.
Yes, who also played at the Théâtre Babylon and was beginning to be more known at the time than Sam, yeah. for some reason. but he was still, again, a foreigner writing in French in Paris. It's interesting that Paris seems to attract a lot of foreign artists and writers and welcomes them, and they blossom in my country.
And as a result of the what was never intended as a career but became a career of publishing and publishing extraordinary writers,
yes,
you got to lead a life which has so many things in it that I can only imagine or dream of. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to go with Jean Genet to the Democratic National Convention in 1968?
Mm. I don't have to. I've already gotten my... Well, it's a long story. When Grove had published all of Genet's plays, and there were actually three or four of the plays were being produced in New York, mm-hmm, and Barney, the head of Grove, and Dick decided we must invite Genet to see his productions. And he was ravi. He said, sure. He went to the American Embassy for his visa, and he received his visa. He went back to his hotel. I have to put a parenthesis. Genet always lived in hotels, never had an apartment. And so he received a phone call in his hotel from the American Embassy saying, sir, we're terribly sorry. We made a mistake. May we have the visa back? You cannot enter the United States. He was overtly homosexual. He was an ex-con, let's face it. Mm-hmm. All the things that, you know, when you have those things, he could say, yes, I've been. So he said very simply, I crossed Paris to get my visa. You will be kind and cross Paris the other way and claim your visa, otherwise I won't go. Okay. Years pass, it's 68. Esquire had the folly of wanting Allen Ginsberg, Jean Genet, Terry Southern, William Burroughs, and a fifth one, I can't remember, to cover the convention. Okay. Jean said, I will only come if Genet and Dick accompany me as my translators, etc. Okay. We all agreed, fine. Of course, we knew he couldn't come in because he had no means to come in. He had no visa. So we crossed him off, and we went off on our vacation with our children. And the phone rang, and, hello, ici Jean. Oh, how are you, Jean? Where are you? I'm in America. You are? How do you do that? Well, he figured out as a French citizen that he did not need a visa to go to Canada, so he went to Montreal and went to campus, and of course he was a hero. He was immediately recognized, and one of the students said, what can I do, Monsieur Genet? It's such an honor to... And Jean simply said, simply? Drive me over the border, thank you. So he arrived in America, and Dick said, oh my God. Going in the most high security place with the police, the CIA, FBI, all over the place, and this guy has no visa. Yikes. And we said to Jean, you're going to be deported. He said, no, don't be so dramatic. Fine. So we did go to Chicago, and he started to write, and he was fascinated by the American uniforms that the police guys were wearing. He was absolutely, he called them, etc. So he was writing his piece from between the legs of the cops.
I've read the piece. I was in Chicago for the riots,
yeah,
and I read assiduously every piece of journalism that came out. And the Genet piece, which I really recommend to you, the first third of it is a rhapsody to the thighs
of the
Chicago police.
Well, so there we were in, I forget, the Hilton Hotel, and he was next to our room, and he would, every morning at 6 o'clock, knock on our door in his little kimono, looking like cherubic, very cute, and he says, bonjour, I want to read you what I wrote during the night. And we said, sure, welcome. He did that, and finally, and he would go right between us in bed, shamelessly. and started to read his piece. At that point, we, I must say, didn't care too much. We wanted to sleep. The third day, we said, we love you, Jean. You got to make it at least 8 o'clock in the morning, not 6. But when we, and Dick translated his pieces, various articles, when we came back to New York, Esquire received us and said very simply, we will not publish your pieces. They're not publishable. And we will give you a kill fee. So he said, qu'est-ce que c'est un kill fee? So we had to explain to him what it was. And he said, no, I will receive my entire fee or else I'm not leaving this building. I'm leaving tomorrow morning on my plane back to Montreal. And the, I forget the name of the head of the Esquire said, Monsieur Genet, we don't have that kind of cash in the office. He said, well, figure it out. I'm not leaving until I am paid. Thank you. Well, they managed to send someone to some bank, and somebody arrived with a wad of bills, which he carefully put in the... He had no bank account anywhere. That was his bank. He put all his money, and he... And, of course, subsequently, was those pieces were published in the Evergreen Review, as you know. So that was one of the things I can remember with Jean in Chicago.
Alan, you had a career not only as a performer of Beckett, but you worked with him in several respects. And if I understand correctly, your encounter with Beckett started, I guess, with Gatto, which I think was published by Grove in, if I get the dates wrong, forgive me, in something like 1954, I think it was on Broadway with Bert Lahr in 1956, and in 1957, you were with the San Francisco Actors Workshop.
Correct.
And then went to San Quentin Prison to do a production of it.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that was like?
Well, it was interesting because they called from the prison one day, and both the artistic directors, Jules Irving and Herb Lau, were teaching full-time at San Francisco State College, and I was running the theater while they were busy doing that. But I got a call from one of the associate wardens. They said that they usually at New Year's, they presented a variety show for the inmates. And all of the acts in San Francisco would volunteer and perform. And they said, but some of the inmates had said, wouldn't it be nice to have a play instead? And so they called and said, would we consider doing a play? There had been no one doing it, and there had been no performer doing a play there since Sarah Bernhardt in 1898 or something. And so I said I would talk to my colleagues about it because I thought it was a very interesting idea. And I called them, and they said, well, yes, good, go ahead, do it, arrange it, so which is what I did. And I called and I said, well, yes, we would be interested in doing the play for you. And they said, well, fine, just a couple of caveats. One is there can be no women. Can't have any women in the prison play. And because it's on the in the large dining hall, we can't have a lot of scenery. And I said, oh, I see, all right. So we got together, we talked about it. The only thing we had was waiting for Godot. At that time, it was called Waiting for Godot, right? And so I called and back, and I said, we have a play. There are four men and a boy, and there's a few rocks and a tree. And they said, sounds terrific. And we told them that this is the play Waiting for Godot. They said, we were doing it only one night a week. At our theater, in repertory, because we weren't sure that the our subscribers would understand what this play was about anyhow. And so a couple of days later, I told them we were setting this up. I was arranging for all the designers and everybody to go over and do this. And I got a call a couple of days later saying they've had a change of heart here. They don't think this is the right play to do. And I said, why? And they said, well... several of our people went over and saw the production, and they just didn't understand anything that was happening. And if they didn't understand it, you can be sure that the inmates won't understand it. And, you know, they would create a riot. And they're already here. We can't do anything more, you know, for them. You know. So I told the director, Herb Blau, I was the assistant director on the production and understudied all the roles. And I told him about it, and he said, well, let me talk to the warden. Can you set that up? And I did. And so he spoke to the warden and told them how he felt it could be presented to the inmates. And the warden finally agreed. He found Blau very convincing, and indeed he was. And so we went ahead that night. And when we got to the... I had never been to a prison before, so it was a fascinating experience for me and for a number of the others. When we got there, you walk in, and you were stamped with a fluorescent stamp. And then two people at a time went down this long sort of cattle run to the other gate. One gate closed behind you, that gate opened, then you were in the courtyard. And as I looked around, they told us not to wear blue jeans because that's what everybody wore, all the inmates. It looked like a lot of college people going to see a show.
So the fluorescent stamp was so that you could get out again?
Yes.
So if you went out, escaping from prison is no more difficult than sneaking into a nightclub?
Yeah. Yes, if you had the stamp, you could get in, yeah. Yes. I mean, not that you would want to. I don't think. So anyhow, what happened. And we went, and but they were very careful about checking Lucky's rope.
There yes,
were two guards watching that.
Sure.
Another thing that was fascinating was that the boy in that production was played by Pozzo's son, Joe Mixack. His son, Spike, who is still with us, played the boy, and he was about, he couldn't have been more than 8 years old. And when he made his entrance, the whistles were deafening.
Ah.
Yes. So that this was a different crowd we were playing to. And once the play began, it was quite clear they understood exactly what waiting was all about. And they understood the play in a way that the warden didn't.
Yeah.
And the review that was written in the prison newspaper, the San Quentin News, was so intelligent that Beckett remarked on the fact he thought it was one of the best reviews ever written.
He told us about
it. Did he tell you that?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that was true. So that's how that happened.
It's a wonderful.
One thing I did want to say about the piece that I read, The Stirring Still, there were actually three fragments. And he wrote this, it was toward the end of his life, and I had lunch with him at one point, and I said, I received the two fragments. I said, and I was so pleased, I hope he would write more. And he said, oh, you've only received two? Well, you didn't get the third? And I said, no, is there a third? Yes. So he sent me the third fragment, and which I told him that, you know, I would be interested in doing it sometime. And he liked that. And I said, I was with a friend of mine who was a playwright, actor, John Cameron Mitchell, who wrote Hedwig and the Angry Inch and several other things. So we were there, and I said to him how much I liked the title. He said he was calling it Stirring Still. And I said, well, I love that title. And he was very pleased. He said, oh, you do? That's awfully nice. I'm so pleased. And I said, yes, Stirring Still. Still meaning yet. And he said, still, silence. I said, well, if that's what you want. So that's where that came from.
And now, I think it was through one of the actors in the 1957 San Quentin production, Rick Clouchy, that you then, 20 years later, got to work with Beckett.
Right. Well, we had sort of introduced the play, Beckett's work, to him, and then in that San Quentin drama workshop, we did Endgame and a whole variety of plays. I remember doing Pinter's The Room, and I ran into Pinter on the street. We were talking about it. I told him that we were going to be doing this play, and I said, you know, there are no royalties, Harold. And he said, oh, no, that was fine. He was pleased to have it done. And said, I said, but we have to change the part of the woman, I think her name is Rose, to a man. And he said, he smiled and said, that's wonderful. He said, it was originally written as a man. He said, I changed it to a woman when we did it at Bristol Old Vic because Vivian Merchant was there, his wife. And so he changed the part so that she could perform
funny.
It. Yeah.
So that brought you over to Germany to actually meet Beckett and work with Beckett. And what was that first encounter like?
Well, it was very strange. I mean, Rick Clucci, who had gotten out of prison, had formed the Barbed Wire Theater. And he had begun writing plays. And it was interesting because when we went there, he said he had never even been to the theater. He said, not even to rob one. I mean, this is a whole new experience for him. And he came out of that prison having written one or two plays, which then they toured across America and then to Europe. And then and we stayed in touch. By that time, I had already gone I'd worked with the inmates for about 6 years or so, and then turned it over to someone else when I left. I was then in New York at Lincoln Center. I mean, I went there. That meant a lot to Rick. I'd helped them out. So when they were in Europe, eventually one day I got a call from Rick who said, I'm working with Beckett. Beckett asked him to become his assistant. Because he'd written to Beckett about doing one of his plays, Endgame. He said, so I'm going to be his assistant. He said, and I've asked him, he's directed me in Kraft's Last Tape, and which Rick is now doing, as a matter of fact, as in Chicago. He said, I've asked him to do Endgame, to direct Endgame. He's refused, but finally has agreed to direct it, and we talked about it, and he wants you to play Nag. Mm. And this was in this phone call, and I said, where are you calling from? I mean, this is so bizarre. He said, I'm in Puerto Rico. And I said, well, of course you are. I mean, I said, well, listen, let me talk to my wife. I'll get right back to you. And I spoke to my wife, and she said, well, if it's for real, you have to do this. And I said, thank you. I wouldn't do it without her. So I called, and I said, all right, well, shortly after that, a telegram arrived from Beckett saying, approve Mandel as Nag. Then I got a ticket to London. I flew over. This was 2 weeks later. I flew to London, and I was met at the airport. We were all in some place near, where is the that part of London? I can't think where all the artists were. Anyhow, I was in this apartment. The next morning, we were in a taxi picking up Samuel Beckett to go to rehearsal. And I was terrified. I thought, if I say anything, he'll think I'm really stupid. So I didn't know what to say. I mean, I didn't say very much except good morning. And so I was at rehearsal for a couple of days. And the woman playing Nell, who was Rick's wife at the time, wasn't there. So after about 2 days of rehearsal, everybody came to rehearsal. It was like this. I mean, the seats would be full with, you know, Beckett scholars and writers and so on, press. He didn't care who came. Nicole Williamson, you know, Albert Finney. You know, I mean, they all came to rehearsal. It was in that part of London, Hammersmith, I guess. Yeah. The studios there. And so after a couple of days, he said, well, I think we should do the Nag Nell scenes. And I was terrified. I said, oh, well, Nell isn't here yet. She'll be a couple of days yet. I've been working like crazy on this. He said, oh, well, he said, why don't we do it? We'll just pull up two chairs, he said, and I'll do Nell and you do Nag.
Oh, dear.
And I thought, my God. It's enough that I'm here. I'm going to be acting with Samuel Beckett. I mean, so we pulled up two chairs, and we were knee to knee, and he started, and he said, what is it, my pet? Time for love? And I said, were you asleep? And then we did the scene, and it was... I don't know how to describe this. It was some strange thing that happened. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do and how he wanted to hear it. And when we finished the scene, it was dead silence. He patted me, he said,
you're going to be very good.
And that was it. And I thought, you could send me home now. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this.
So. You once described Beckett's process of directing as conducting a piece of music. You talked about his sense of tone, rhythm, pace, timing, and
rhythm
pauses. And so can you talk a little bit about sort of the musicality of the language as Beckett directed it and how he did that and what that was like?
Well, he was really, I mean, his plays, for which he's more famous than for his novels, really. I mean, I think so. He was a poet, and you can scan that, and everything was about rhythm.
Yes.
And you would, as you worked on a scene, he had these. You remember his fingers, this finger, they were bent. I don't know what it was, but he would be there, and when he raised his hand, that was the end of a pause, right? And then as I learned later, you know, the pauses, and Pinter went through this too, you know, the pauses were a musical beat, and a silence was a musical rest.
Yeah.
No longer, no shorter. And when I talked to Pinter once about this, he was saying he had just seen a production of The Caretaker that was endless. He said, oh, you can't believe. He said, you think, the pauses were this long? He said, the silences, he said, were just out of this world. He said, he got up and left. He couldn't take it anymore, this production. He said, you worked with Sam. He said, you know what a pause is. I said, yes, well, it's like a hitch. He said, well, what the hell's a hitch? And I said, well, like a beat. He said, yes, it's a beat, a musical beat. He said, pause. I wish I'd never heard of the fucking word. So when Beckett directed, or if I worked with him on, I did a one-person play of his called Company, and we spent quite a bit of time together going over it so that I would get it. And when I heard him speak, you've heard him speak, he has that, he had a slight lisp.
Yes.
But it was that wonderful Irish musicality.
Yes,
and the Irish,
absolutely.
I have to tell you, they are very musical.
I mean, yes.
Wherever when I worked in Dublin, I asked him once. We were rehearsing. He didn't like to go to the theater. He didn't come to the theater. And when we finished doing Endgame, he said we were going to open at the Abbey Theater. And I said, oh, I was excited and looking forward to him coming. He said, no, I wouldn't go. He said, you'll do a recording. You'll send me the recording. And I'll tell you whether it's right or wrong. And I said, oh, all right. And I said, well, why won't you come? And he said, because, he said, they'd eat me up alive. And you realize when you're there in Dublin, it's a very small city, there's no privacy of any kind. Everybody knows what everyone's doing. You know?
But Beckett was a very, very fine musician
himself. Yes, yes.
He played the piano and knew a great deal about music.
Right. And
music was very important to him.
Yes, and a mathematician as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's right.
And everything was measured exactly.
Yes.
So if you read any of his plays and there's a measurement, you can be sure he measured it.
Yes, true.
Yes.
I could talk to Alan and Jeanette all evening. And in fact, there's a question I want to ask you, which I'm going to save maybe for the end of the evening. But, as the master would say, every word is a stain upon silence and nothingness. So let's go to the audience for some questions. I think microphones will be provided you.
Is it possible to find the San Quentin Review?
To find it?
Yes. Is it published anyplace?
Yes, it is. It's published in the San Quentin News. I suppose if you write to them, my copy is now at UCLA. I've given them all my files, which also had about 28 letters from Beckett in their envelopes. I gave them all to UCLA.
Hearing of those productions almost makes you want to go to jail.
Alan, it's Jan.
Hello, Jan.
I have two questions. Beckett wrote earlier in his early career in French, and you're saying that someone else translated it into English. He never did his own translations.
He translated himself.
Yes.
Did he continue to write in French throughout his whole life?
No.
Or did he switch over to English?
In fact, one of the pieces he wrote was called Worst Word Ho. And so I tried to read Worst Word Ho, and I was having a terrible time. And I told him, and I said, you know, I have to tell you, Sam, I'm having great difficulty with this. And he said, oh, Alan, it's so difficult I can't even translate it.
And I have one more question, only because I've always been curious about it.
Thank you.
When Alan Schneider directed film, Sam Beckett, to me, match made in heaven, Sam Beckett and Buster Keaton. Was Keaton aware of who he was? Was he aware of the background? Was he aware? I mean, obviously Beckett was aware of Keaton because the whole world was aware of Keaton.
Can I answer that question?
Anyone can answer that question. So I'm fascinated by that whole particular piece of film.
The only thing I'll say you can anyway. Ask is that Keaton, you should know, was very ill during that shooting. That's one thing. Go ahead.
Keaton had no clue. Very simple. Zero. And what is interesting, as the production was underway, he somehow understood, and Sam was mesmerized at how this man who had never read a word of or didn't know who Beckett was, what it meant, what the play or the film meant, all of a sudden he got it, and he was enchanted with Keaton's perception and acting, but he did not know until that day who he was.
It was not a happy experience for Beckett.
No. Well, he was excited, though.
Well, he may have been at the beginning, but it was his first trip to America. He never came back, and he had no desire to come back.
In all fairness, it was a very, very hot moment. It was one of those heat waves.
Yes.
And but he did. Dick took him to a baseball game.
Oh, he did.
And
the Mets, Shea Stadium, they lost.
And it was really, he was so excited. He would get up every 2 minutes, and he kept saying it was like cricket, which it isn't. But it was a wonderful experience for him. Yeah. He loved it. He also played tennis with Dick that time. They went to Barney's place in the Hamptons.
Well, that may have been the happier time for him. Yeah. But the filming was not.
It was complicated.
It was very difficult. Yeah. Yes. One of the things also I just say is that in meeting him during rehearsal, I would go over and ask something. I would say, well, Mr. Beckett, if I'm going to be in, he'd stop me and say, please, you must call me Sam. And I said, yes, Mr. Beckett. He said, no, really, you must call me Sam. I found this so difficult. I finally, said, yes, Sam. But when I spoke about him, and often when I speak about him, I often speak about Beckett or Mr. Beckett. The only time I ever call him Sam is if I'm talking to somebody who's worked with him or knows him, then you'd call him Sam. I just found it very difficult.
You're right. Dick had known him for quite a number of months and kept calling him Mr. Beckett. And like you, he said, oh, for God's sake, call me Sam. And it took him a while, true, to...
But he said to me, he said, I don't call you Mr. Mandel. And I said, well, it's not the same thing. He said, yes, it is. It's the same.
Mr. Mandel, I saw you last year in Godot, and you were so brilliant. And I wanted to ask you, when Beckett, when you worked with Beckett as a director, did he ever give you notes around psychological motivation for character, or what did he talk about? How did he talk about his characters and his stories?
Well, one of the things I was playing Lucky, right? So when the production you just saw where I played Gogo Estragon, he didn't talk about motivation, character. All the actors, studios, that's a whole different world for him. He talked about, he would stop you and say, did I write it's or it is?
if you said it's and it was, it is, he said it changes the scansion of the line. Mm. So that's how that's why I say he conducted, you know. Mm. And he listened to it. And you knew your lines when you went in. I mean, I owed that to him. I was word by word. You could have stopped me anywhere and I could tell you exactly where to pick up and continue, you know, and what the rhythm of the piece was. And the same was in doing Lucky's speech, you know, which is this...
It's a great speech.
Long, wonderful it's speech. It's
a sort of history of Western civilization. And in order to get that, you had to have the rhythm of the piece or you couldn't do it. And in doing this production that we did recently, Hugo, who was brilliant as Lucky, was having a great deal of difficulty at the beginning. And so he asked Barry McGovern and myself if we could give him some pointers. And all we talked about was, you know, the rhythm of the piece and being able to take your time with it, you know, that was you up there, you know, doing this. So, and the dance and everything. And as you say, you know, he was so musical.
He was.
So, yes. So that was it. We didn't talk about what was the history, you know, where was Lucky born and who was his parents and what was his emotional memory, you know, and the sense memory and so we didn't do that.
Howard, we're going to give you the last question there.
Well, the last question that I was going to ask was, I think, something that Jeanette has already brought up, which is I wanted to know what it was like going to Shea Stadium to see the Mets with Sam Beckett. But
I wasn't there. Dick did.
Okay.
I was taking care of my children that night.
But so why don't we leave the last question to somebody from the audience?
So I'm curious, having described Beckett as very private and someone who didn't pick up his own telephone, what do each of you think he responded to in you? Like how, why, what, when, where, you know?
What do you mean? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Oh, well, how did he respond to us?
Yeah, like there a moment or what was it about you that you felt you were able to...
Because he, as far as I'm concerned, he... It's very hard to describe. It's a good question. It's a difficult answer. I felt totally embraced, and I felt he cared. He looked at you and wanted a profound answer, not a superficial answer. You sensed a great warmth, you felt you were in with him, or not, as the case may be, but we did. And he adored my husband. And I think he liked me a lot, too. I mean, you felt it, some imponderable, and you can't quite describe. But he was otherwise reserved. If you met him in the street, he'd be polite, but he'd be very reserved. So it wasn't a given. So I felt very privileged, yes. Sorry.
Well, I felt, I honestly felt it. It's so bizarre that this Nobel Prize winner, this great man and so on, was my friend. I mean,
I know
it was really.
It's wonderful.
Sort of difficult for me to comprehend for the long. But he was so lovely. I mean, you know, he was lovely to my wife and to my son, and my daughter has never forgiven me for not taking her there. You know.
There's as many thanks as there were when we began this evening. There's even more now. I'd really like to thank both Alan Mandel and Jeanette Seaver, not only for giving up their time.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.